morning and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Gene Bauer. Bauer is president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary, the leading farm animal protection organization in the country, with sanctuaries in Watkins Glen, New York, and Orland, California. Farm Sanctuary works to end cruelty to farm animals and promotes compassionate living through rescue, education, and advocacy. In March, Bauer published a book about the founding and mission of his organization. It's called Farm Sanctuary, Changing Hearts and Minds About Animals and Food, and it was published by Touchstone Books. Welcome to the show, Gene.
Oh, it's great to be here with you, Tish. Thanks.
Now, your passion for animals began as a child growing up in Hollywood, California. In fact, you described yourself as enchanted by them. Talk to us about that.
That's right. I grew up in the Hollywood Hills near Griffith Park, and there were deer that would come into my parents' backyard. I remember one time a deer had actually, rubbed off and left his antlers in the backyard. Coyotes in the neighborhood, skunks. I remember one time coming across a coyote den. And
wow.
Just seeing the wild animals was, I think most children have a natural connection to animals and are in awe of nature and animals. And that was the case with me. And I also had a cat named Tiger, who was a very good friend of mine, and realized, what the companionship of an animal could mean from a very early age.
Now, you started Farm Sanctuary in 1986. And tell us about Hilda, the first animal that you saved.
Yes. Well, when we started Farm Sanctuary back in 1986, there was very little known about what was happening to animals on farms, at least in terms of the mainstream. I mean, the factory farmers knew what they were doing, but most other people didn't. So we wanted to go in and document conditions, and as we did, we would find living animals literally thrown in trash cans or living animals left for dead on piles of dead animals. And that was the case with Hilda. She was a lamb who had been dumped on the dead pile behind Lancaster Stockyards in Pennsylvania. And as we approached this pile, there were dead cows and dead pigs and dead sheep. And there were maggots. They were so thick, they were buzzing. And out of this pile, this lamb lifts her head. We were stunned that a live animal would be dumped here. So took her from the dead pile, found a veterinarian, and brought her to the veterinarian thinking she would probably have to be euthanized. But as the veterinarian started examining her and prodding her and checking her out, she perked up and she stood up within a half hour, and she lived with us for more than 10 years. So Hilda was our first rescued animal, and many have followed since.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Oh, it's beautiful to see an animal who had literally been thrown away as garbage, left for dead, rescued and allowed and able to live a great life. And it's beautiful to see animals when they, first come to the farm. They're often frightened and because all they have known at human hands has been cruelty. And when they're treated with kindness, they respond and they blossom. And it's a beautiful thing to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think most people would be able to identify that if they have animals in their own homes.
Absolutely.
All animals are the same.
That's right. And we're all products of our experiences and our, past memories. And, these animals, the fact that they can learn to trust us and to befriend us says an awful lot about the importance of forgiveness.
Now, I'm really interested in this fact. When you started Farm Sanctuary, you raised funds by selling tofu hot dogs at Grateful Dead concerts. Talk to us about those early days.
That's right. Farm Sanctuary started as a grassroots organization, and we remain a grassroots organization at our heart. And the way we did fund it in the early days was by traveling around with the Grateful Dead and selling vegetarian hot dogs in the parking lots at Grateful Dead concerts. We had these big meatless hot dog signs, and we also had displays and information about what was happening to animals on factory farms. And I think, the Grateful Dead audience was quite a receptive, open-minded audience. So I think there was an interest in vegetarianism, and many people became vegetarian after learning about what happens to animals on farms and recognizing that there are good, healthy vegetarian alternatives.
Mm-hmm. And you found the piece of land in Watkins Glen soon after you started the organization. Well, what kind of reception did you get from the people in Watkins Glen? Did you have to educate?
Well, when we first came to Watkins Glen, we came into a community that was very much steeped in a culture of animal exploitation. One of our neighbors, for example, was a fox farmer and a trapper, and he asked if he could trap animals on our property. And of course, we said, no, we're an animal protection group, and we would not allow hunting or trapping or any other such thing. And many of the other neighbors also asked if they could hunt, and we said no. So we were a whole different kind of neighbor than they had been used to. And that took some getting acclimated to. But over time, I think they recognize that, you know, we care about the community. We care about preserving a sort of way of life that is respectful of nature. And they've warmed up to us. And it's been very good to see. So some of the people, in fact, from the community who had, you know, grown up in families that were very much on the other side of these issues are now working at the farm. And I hope to see more and more people from the community coming out and spending time with the animals at Farm Sanctuary.
Uh-huh. Now, the earliest and still ongoing campaign was the No Downer campaign. Talk to us about that and the evolution, and has anything changed?
Well, yeah, that's right. We started with protecting animals that are downed, and these are animals that are too sick to walk. You know, Hilda, for example, was a downed animal. She was too sick to walk, so she was dumped on the dead pile. We found many other downed animals left to die in alleyways or pens or at stockyards, slaughterhouses, and farms. And our position from the beginning was that these animals should not just be discarded as garbage. They should be treated like living, feeling creatures and be given proper veterinary care to be made healthy, or they should be humanely euthanized and put out of their misery. They shouldn't just be left to linger and to suffer. But unfortunately, these animals could still be taken to slaughterhouses and used for human food. And that's why there was an economic incentive against humanely euthanizing them. And there was also generally an incentive against providing them with veterinary care, because usually the veterinary care would be somewhat costly and the value of the animal may be less than the cost of the veterinary care. So again, these animals were just left to suffer and linger. So that campaign continues, and we continue urging that these downed animals be given veterinary care or euthanized. And we've had some success. We passed a law in California, and we've passed several other laws in various states requiring that these animals be given veterinary care or be euthanized. And in fact, earlier this year, there was a massive expose of the mistreatment of downed cows at a slaughterhouse in Southern California. And as a result of that expose and the laws that we had worked to put in place, that slaughterhouse faced the largest beef recall in U.S. history. So there are some regulations and restrictions on what happens to downed cows right now, but those restrictions do not currently apply to pigs or sheep or other animals. So we're trying to broaden the no-downer policy to apply to all species of animals, and also to apply it at the state level, because the law that was enforced in California was the California law, but also a federal law. Many other states do not have protections, and the federal law only applies to federal slaughterhouses, not to stockyards and other facilities. Mm. So we've had some progress, but we still have a long way to go.
And I think people don't understand when you talk about downer animals. You're talking about animals that end up in the food supply.
That is right. I mean, these are downed animals, and we actually took the USDA to court starting in the late 1990s, arguing that these downed animals are diseased, and diseased animals, by law, cannot be used for human food. But the USDA responded to our petition and said that it was appropriate and legal and common for diseased animals to be used for human food. And they put that in writing, and we were pretty surprised they did. In response, we sued them, and we went to court, and we battled them out for a few years, and our case was dismissed a couple of times, but we kept appealing it. Finally, we won a court victory in December of 2003, on December 16th specifically, that would have allowed our case to go forward and allowed us to conduct discovery and to get into the files and so on of the USDA. Less than 2 weeks later, the USDA announced that they had found mad cow disease in a downed cow. And once that happened, we began settlement negotiations, and they agreed that downed cows should not go into the human food supply, you know, because of disease threats, including the threat of mad cow disease, which we had been concerned about because there had been evidence we had mad cow disease in the U.S. since the early 1990s. You know, our concern is that the USDA has generally taken a don't look, don't find approach to disease. There's sort of an economic incentive not to find disease.
Exactly.
You know, because if you find it, you're now liable or accountable for it. And it also tends to shut down export markets. There was actually a slaughterhouse in Kansas who wanted to test all of their cows for mad cow disease. And they wanted to do that so that they could export beef to other countries who would only take it if they tested all the animals. But the USDA actually took this slaughterhouse to court and said that they could not test all the cows for mad cow disease. It's pretty shocking that the USDA took a strong position on this. And one has to ask why. And the USDA's response is that, well, if they test all of the cows for mad cow disease, then other slaughterhouses might be expected to do it. So that's the USDA's response. But I think that, frankly, we probably have a lot more mad cow disease in this country than we know about. And perhaps the USDA is concerned that if all of the animals were tested, we might be finding a lot greater incidence of mad cow disease than the USDA wants to admit exists.
Yeah, and the USDA and the FDA, and we have to be skeptical about these organizations. We used to think of them as pristine protectors of the country. Now, I want to ask you this. Are farm animals still not covered in cruelty laws?
Yeah, unfortunately, the laws as they pertain to farm animal welfare are grossly inadequate. Farm animals are specifically excluded from the Federal Animal Welfare Act. Farm animals are also excluded from most state anti-cruelty laws if the practices are considered to be common agricultural practices. Beginning in the 1980s, agribusiness got very active in state legislatures across the U.S. and amended state anti-cruelty laws. You know, laws that would say things like you need to provide adequate food, water, shelter, and veterinary care for animals. Those laws then had an exemption added to say that, you know, animals have to be provided food, water, veterinary care, and shelter, except in the case of common agricultural practices.
Oh, that's
so if agriculture starts doing something, they can do whatever they want, and it's considered to be common. And so in the last couple decades, we've seen horrible practices become common and normal. Bad has become normal on the farm, and we're now trying to push back and trying to change that.
Tell us about the incredibly sad lives of veal calves. This issue has to be something people need to pay attention to.
Absolutely. Well, to raise veal, young calves are taken away from their mothers immediately at birth, and then they're chained by the neck in small crates, and that's where they live their whole lives, unable to walk, turn around, or exercise. These calves are also fed a diet that is deficient in iron and fiber, and that is designed to produce a borderline anemia to get this pale-colored meat that is sold as veal. So we've encouraged people to not eat veal. You know, it's one of these very cruel products. And we've also now started working on some legislative efforts to ban the inhumane confinement of animals in veal crates. We worked on an initiative in Arizona that passed in 2006 that bans the use of veal crates in Arizona. And that initiative also bans the use of gestation crates, which are 2-foot-wide metal enclosures where breeding pigs live for practically their whole lives. And we're now, in fact, working on a very important effort in California. It's Proposition 2 that's going to be on the ballot in November. And it will ban the use of veal crates for calves, gestation crates for the pigs, and it will also ban the use of battery cages. These are small wire enclosures where egg-laying hens are confined for a year or longer, and they're packed so tightly they can't even stretch their wings. They're constantly rubbing against the wire sides of their enclosures, and their feathers rub off. They have bruises and abrasions on their bodies. And this is how most of the eggs in this country are now being raised. So we are trying to ban the use of that inhumane system in California. And so Election Day this November will be very pivotal for the farm animal protection movement.
And the food industry, I assume, is fighting back, right?
That's right.
Will they say that the veal industry will go out of business if these calves can't be raised that way?
Well, they're saying in California, there's not a huge veal industry that we know of, and the pig industry is not that massive either, but the egg industry is quite large. There are about 19 million egg-laying hens confined in these battery cages in California. California is the sixth largest egg-producing state. So we're up against a big industry, primarily the egg industry, and they're pouring millions of dollars into the campaign to try to defeat this measure, and they are saying that, in fact, this will destroy the entire egg industry in California. But, you know, the industry as it exists now needs to change. It is unacceptable, it is untenable, it is abusive, it is also very wasteful. There are external costs associated with this factory farming system, you know, ranging from environmental pollution, the destruction of rural communities and the environment, human health risks. You know, these animals are confined in stressful, overcrowded, filthy conditions, and so there's a greater likelihood of disease and pathogen spreading. So there's a lot of external costs that need to be looked at, and hopefully this will push agriculture in a better direction if it passes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gene Bauer. He's president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary, and he's just recently written a book called Farm Sanctuary, Changing Hearts and Minds About Animals and Food. Now, one of the things you talk about in your book is the fact that early on you decided you would name all your farm animals on the farm sanctuary grounds. Tell us about that philosophy.
Well, once the animals come to farm sanctuary, they are our friends, not our food. Each of them is an individual with a personality. And so we give them names, and we treat them just like most people treat their cats or dogs or other companion animals. And, you know, from our standpoint, farm animals have feelings, and they have the same kinds of emotions and needs, and they develop relationships with other animals and other people just like cats and dogs. But unfortunately, in our country, we tend to put a line between the animals we call pets and the animals we call dinner. And we're trying to destroy that line and let folks know that, like all animals, farm animals deserve to be treated with compassion.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about one of your most famous residents, Cincy Freedom. Tell us the story.
Oh, Cincy Freedom escaped from a slaughterhouse in Ohio. And she was there, and she was in line to be, you know, basically killed. And she didn't want to have any part of that, so she made a run for it. And she jumped over a gate and ran through the streets and then ran into the woods. And she was there for a couple of weeks before she could be caught.
And this was in 2002, right?
This was in 2002, mm-hmm. Yes, just outside of Cincinnati, Ohio. And when she made her run for life, you know, people in the community and around the country rallied behind her, which we often see when you have an animal who has escaped that fate and is just trying to save themselves. You know, people around the country really rally and root for that individual. And that's what happened with Cincy Freedom. And thankfully, she was able to come to Farm Sanctuary. And that happened, you know, thanks to the support of people like Peter Max.
I was just going to say, he got involved, didn't he?
He sure did. Peter Max got involved and, you know, called the mayor and convinced the mayor and other people in Cincinnati that this animal should come to Farm Sanctuary, and thankfully she did.
Mm-hmm. And when somebody does call you to bring animals to Farm Sanctuary, how does that happen? Do you have to rent a truck? Do you have a rescue squad? How does that work?
Yeah, we have a whole shelter team and trucks that go out and help rescue animals when needed. But like all shelters, we have limited space, you know, so we can't bring in all the animals, unfortunately. There are literally 10 billion farm animals raised and slaughtered in the U.S. every year. We rescue as many as we can, and we currently have over 1,000 animals between our two shelters. But we also need to go upstream and prevent the cruelties. But in terms of the shelter, we do have an excellent staff that goes out. We just brought in almost 70 pigs from Iowa, for example, mm-hmm. during the floods. You know, when the floods hit, a lot of these factory farms were underwater. In some cases, the pigs were left in the cages and crates to drowned. In other situations, the pigs were able to get out of the barns, and then they struggled for their lives, and they were swimming to high ground. Some got to levees, some got to the woods, and our staff was out there working to find these animals and working with local authorities to gain custody of these animals. And many just came back to Farm Sanctuary, and they're now being nursed back to health.
Mm-hmm. The pigs out there are just absolutely magnificent. Oh. And then tell me, you mentioned this in your book, that you think pigs are more like human beings than any other farm animal. To talk to us about your love for pigs.
Yeah, I think that's right. Pigs are more like people than any other farm animal, as far as I can tell. When you look at them, pigs' eyes look very much like people's eyes. And pigs have social environments very similar to people. They raise their young cooperatively in groups. The mother pigs will babysit for each other.
That's great.
I think Winston Churchill said something like, you know, dogs look up to people and cats look down on people, but pigs will look you straight in the eye. And I think he really got that right.
The pigs are just wonderful. Anybody who hasn't been out to the Farm Sanctuary, you've got to go meet the pigs and roll around in the hay with them.
Oh, my. And, you know, pigs are so earthy, too. You know, they're so earthy. They root in the soil. They love to be on the dirt. And that's why, you know, the factory farming confinement that they experience is so brutal. These animals also have very sensitive noses. You know, they root up truffles in France, for example, so they can smell under the soil. But in these factory farms, they live on concrete floors over these cesspits full of excrement that are, you know, have noxious fumes that they breathe in day after day. So their confinement and their abuse is even that much worse when you recognize the sensitivity of these animals and their ability to smell so well.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the dairy industry. I know you're not only, you know, worried and concerned about the animals, but what about the health and environmental issues in regard to the dairy industry?
Well, the dairy industry has been seen as sort of this American positive institution for too long. And, you know, school children are required to be given cow's milk for the school lunch program. And this is despite the fact that many people are lactose intolerant. And, you know, cow's milk is not something that's really that good for us. In fact, it's bad for us. And, you know, the dairy industry is quick to say that drinking cow's milk prevents osteoporosis. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that in this country, we drink a lot of cow's milk, and we also have a lot of osteoporosis. So the empirical evidence does not suggest that drinking cow's milk prevents osteoporosis. And, you know, cow's milk also is something that is meant for calves. It's not meant for human beings. And I think people need to ask themselves, you know, what other species drinks the milk of another species? You know, we're drinking cow's milk now in this country on a regular basis. Why don't we drink dog's milk or giraffe's milk or pig's milk or, you know, some other kind of mammal's milk? There's really no reason to be drinking the milk of another species. And there's also no reason to be drinking milk past weaning. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's so many other things that we can drink that are healthy. The other thing about cow's milk is that, you know, it has somatic cell counts. It has basically pus cells in it. And in the United States, we allow a much higher level of these than is allowed in other countries. So the U.S. agribusiness industry has worked to pass regulations that are very lax and allow, you know, problems into the food supply, you know, pus in milk or, you know, bacteria or feces that then consumers are expected to cook. So,
and then what about the hormones that they constantly are putting into cows especially?
That's a very good point. You know, in the dairy industry, bovine growth hormone is used to enhance and promote more milk production. And this despite the fact that these cows are already pushed to their biological limits. You know, in a natural environment, a cow would live 25 years. But in these factory farms, they only last in production about 3 or 4 years. Mm. So when you have these cows that are being pushed that much harder, you know, by giving these hormones, they're under more stress. They're more likely to have more, you know, infections in their udders. Mastitis, for example, is a common problem on today's dairies, which is a bacterial infection of the udder. They also have, you know, more pus cells in the milk. And the animals are also more likely to need antibiotics. And that's a whole nother huge problem on today's farm, where antibiotics are routinely used to promote faster growth and keep the animals alive in these disease-ridden conditions. So we have the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that then threatens human health. So we have a huge problem here in terms of animal abuse, in terms of what consumers face, you know, the health risks they face from pathogens and so on, and then the environment that's being destroyed. Because you have, when you have hundreds or thousands of animals confined in a small area, you have a concentration of manure. The U.S. Senate report came out a number of years ago talking about how the livestock industry produces 130 times more manure than the human population in the U.S. Mm. Now, in the case of human manure, it is managed, and there is a way to deal with it. In the case of animal manure on factory farms, there is not an adequate system in place to manage and regulate that. So we have that, you know, getting into the environment, polluting rivers, polluting waterways, and it's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You've been an activist as a farm sanctuary president and co-founder for about 22 years now. Well, what's your proudest achievement in these last 22 years?
I think that today we have more awareness about what happens to animals on farms and more awareness about the many problems associated with industrialized animal farming than ever before. And I think that's the thing I'm most proudest of, is this growing awareness. We've passed some laws, and I think that's all very good. But at the end of the day, this system requires a cultural shift. And I do believe we are starting to see the beginnings of that now. In addition to passing some laws, we're seeing the United Nations coming out with a report talking about how the livestock industry is a greater contributor to global warming than the entire transportation industry. The Pew Charitable Trusts put together a commission to examine industrial animal production, and they concluded that industrial animal production is bad for animals, bad for consumers, bad for rural communities, and bad for the environment, and they also called for changes. And this was a commission that was comprised of various experts, including agricultural officials, like USDA Secretary Dan Glickman, you know, former Secretary Dan Glickman. So we have now a growing awareness and concern that is reaching to mainstream in a way as never before. And I think with that, the best changes are yet to come.
Mm-hmm. And you were on the show a little over 3 years ago with me talking about this issue. It seems to me there's been a huge change in people's attitudes about animal welfare. Why do you think that has happened? And more famous people getting involved, different kinds of campaigns? You guys have been part of it, but why do you think it's changed so much?
Well, I think that things have gotten so bad, and I think people were unaware of what was happening on farms. And in recent years, people have started to see images of factory farming and see the reality of what happens to animals in slaughterhouses. And it's not pretty, and it is viscerally upsetting. I think the internet has played a very important role because now information is much more widely accessible. And, you know, what's been happening on farms is appalling to citizens when they see it. And mm-hmm. so now people are seeing it, and they're speaking out against it. And some of the other costs of industrialized animal agriculture are coming to light in terms of the environmental pollution. There was an article that ran earlier this year in the New York Times called Rethinking the Meat Guzzler, and it compared the amount of fossil fuels required to produce a vegetarian meal versus to produce a meat meal. And they concluded that the meat meal required 16 times more fossil fuels than the vegetarian meal. Mm. So we have acknowledged that we have an issue in this country with being addicted to oil, but we have not properly recognized that our addiction to oil is driven in no small part by our addiction to animal products.
Mm-hmm. And like I said in the intro, there's a farm sanctuary in Watkins Glen and also in Orland, California. And you say in the afterword of your book that you hope to expand and create more farm sanctuaries around the country. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes. You know, we think it's very important for people to have a chance to come meet farm animals and to look into the eyes of a pig and to give them a belly rub, to get to know a turkey or a chicken or a cow. And if we can open facilities closer to big cities, they would be accessible to more people. So that is our hope, and we're looking at various options along those lines right now.
Uh-huh. And what do you say to people who still call you a terrorist and a wacko? And
well, you know, I think that, you know, people are afraid of change, and, you know, we're asking people to question some of their basic assumptions about how we treat other animals. And so when people look at us and try to dismiss our concerns and dismiss our point of view and to do so in some cases with ad hominem attacks, mm-hmm. you know, we just sort of see them for what they are. And I think that, you know, people are just afraid of change. And our goal is to try to raise awareness, to educate people, and as Gandhi said, to bring people to their senses, not to their knees. So when people are critical and dismissive of us, you know, we just got to let that roll by and just continue coming forward with the facts and the information and encouraging people to think clearly about what they're eating and about the consequences of their food choices. And we ask people to eat in a way that is consistent with their own ideals and their own conscience. And I think if people look at these issues with an open mind and clear vision, change will happen.
Gene Bauer, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and please go out and get his book. It's called Farm Sanctuary, Changing Hearts and Minds About Animals and Food. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tish. Really appreciate it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman. Mm-hmm.